Otherwise, what are we doing today? We will be starting with a slightly demanding part, which we'll go through in maybe 10 minutes max. Then we introduce a new lecture, a new language. The new language will be mind-blowingly small and extremely powerful. See what we can do there, and then we will define what concurrency is actually about. So far, so good. Let's jump right into it. Let me shrink myself to a much more handy mouse pointer. And let's start with that. There we go. Unfortunately, somehow I managed to... Yes. Now I'm on top of things. Good. Literally. So, that is the last aspect of ADAP programming, which I wanted to briefly show you. Now, as I say here, this is for the advanced students. So, everybody lean back, see how much of that you get. This is a little bit more complicated. I know that all of you at the moment come in here with a background in object-oriented programming. I also know from experience that very few of you actually know what happens if you use object-oriented programming. Now, ADA, compared also to C++ and other languages, is a little bit more explicit in these things. It doesn't hide things away from you. It doesn't make it obscure what is happening behind the scene. You are in control. Sounds good. But it also means you need to know what you're doing. And hence, it really helps to actually have understood what happens if you use object-oriented programming behind the scene. Now, you all can tell me the stories about animals and bicycle parts and geometric objects and how this all comes cozy together in packages which are nicely hidden away from everybody else. We all know that story. Do you actually know what the compiler does if you use object-oriented programming, or what the compiler has to do if you use object-oriented programming, as opposed to any other modularization technology like abstract data types, generic programming, and any other modularization method which is out there? Object-oriented programming allows you to dynamically dispatch to operations at runtime which are only known at runtime. You do not necessarily know what the procedures will look like, what the operations will look like before you actually run the program. This is called dynamic dispatching. Giving you a simple example of that. If you have an array of a bunch of different objects and you want to call a function on those objects, you know that these functions will be dispatched according to the kind of object at hand. So if your object looks like a kitten or a triangle or a bicycle, the function give me the surface area of it, give me the size of it, will be completely different depending on the object, right? This cannot be determined at compile time. This is a runtime operation, hence dynamic dispatching as opposed to static. Okay, which is also the reason why this form of modularization is not only frowned upon, but often literally forbidden in high integrity systems, because you actually need to know what is happening at runtime. So, how does that look in the concurrent world? And I go full on in this example here. This gives you the power to dynamically dispatch directly into other tasks, into other concurrent objects. We don't really have the full theoretical backing for that at this point, so take this with a grain of salt, what you see here on the screens. We start off with why can it be determined at compile time? Okay, fair question. You have a program which has a number of different objects of different geometric types, right? You have a base geometric object and you have derived child objects, which are circular objects and then oval objects and then polygons, etc., etc. For all of these functions, you override a new area or size function. Now, at runtime, you can create, read in from external sources, dynamically create arrays of these objects. And you go through this object with a for loop, for object one to object last. Give me on the terminal the size of all of these objects. And you just say size of the object you find in this array element. And this is completely runtime dependent. How large is this array? What elements are in this array? You cannot possibly know this at compile time. Does that make sense? Cool. So back to the example here. In order to do this cleanly in a concurrent world, we first define an abstract queue definition. Abstract here means the following. We have a synchronized interface, and all of our operations are abstract. They don't exist. They're only here as a template so that I can derive further packages from that will actually fill in the goods and will tell you what the NQ and DQ procedures look like. The only constraint which I have here at the moment is that whatever I use to implement that, this interface, the routines which I provide for that one, have to be synchronized. This is a constraint which I introduce here so that I can use this package in a concurrent world. So I say whatever you use to implement your queue, it has to provide a synchronized interface so that it can live up to the constraints of concurrent programming. We have seen so far one possibility of doing that. That was the protected object, but there will be other ways of doing that. So this is a generic specification of this fact. We don't want to specify it in full. We don't know quite yet. So these routines are abstract, which means we don't have to provide anything for that. They are definitely not existent. But we have to override them, of course. The moment we inherit from this package and write a new package to fill in the implementation, we have to provide the actual detail for that. Why can't we determine at compile time? Surely the compiler would know when we instantiate objects. No, but you don't. You have to solve the halting problem to know that before. You can instantiate one object, no object, 500 objects, 20 objects of circles and 50 objects of squares. This is all determined at runtime, not at compile time. Okay. Somebody outside of your program creates objects? No. You are creating as many objects as you want dynamically. The number of objects you create is not static. That's the charm of object-oriented programming. This is why you want to have object-oriented programming. If you don't want that, if you want to have everything static, you can use much cleaner technology, like, for example, abstract data types, where you don't have this power. Okay, so you will have seen in all of your object-oriented programming environments, regardless whether you do this in Python or Java or God knows what, if condition so-and-so, instantiate another object, right? Or not. Good. So I think that's... Yeah, good. Glad we made progress there. Beautiful. So, and we don't need to have an implementation package, obviously, for an abstract interface, because it actually doesn't exist. There will definitely be no code for this. So how can we make use of that? And here it becomes the first, here comes the first mind bender, which will kick your brain into overdrive straight away. That one. This is a list of generic parameters, right? Now, you all like the second parameter. The second parameter is just a handover and index type to define the size of my queue. We have seen that before. That was easy. Right? We have another generic parameter now, and this other generic parameter is another package, an instantiation of another package. Now it becomes interesting. So you can instantiate a package and then hand over this package as a parameter to instantiate yet another package. What this package here requires, this is the package qpack concrete. This actually implements things. This qpack concrete says, I want to use qpack abstract, which is an abstract interface, but I expect a concrete instantiation of that before I can actually write my implementation. What does this concrete implementation provide? Not much besides the type. If you look what we have done in the previous interface, this abstract type need to be instantiated, this abstract package need to be instantiated with a concrete type. So by getting an instantiation of this package, we will gain directly the type which we can then use here. So our type element is defined nowhere here, right? It comes with the instantiation of this package. Is from here on, it becomes a little easier. Then we have the same implementation what we have before. We are using what we have been doing before because it qualifies for a synchronized interface. We can use a protected type to implement this interface. But we have to say this is overriding. We can add more functions which are not required by our abstract interface, but we can, of course, like in any object-oriented environment, provide more methods, operations on our objects. But we have to explicitly provide the methods which are mandatory for this object, which is DQ and NQ. Okay. So far, so obvious. I can, if I'm feeling like it, explicitly say this is not overriding, but this is the default, so you don't actually have to say that. Now, it's a bit of a stretch. Anything on this slide not perfectly clear? I would say that 80% of you are a little on wobbly feet at the moment, and this is okay. So if you get some rough idea what this means to instantiate new packages, this is already enough at this time. Hang on, what's the difference between generic types and abstract types? There's a generic package, there's not a generic type. If I said generic type, okay. There's a generic package. And an abstract package means it doesn't exist. Abstract means there is no implementation for that. Right? So. Can you go very quickly about overriding? Yes, of course. These two routines, NQ and DQ, they have been specified in our abstract package. And as they have been specified there, and our protected queue is defined as a new queue interface, so this is a derived one, there's a new queue interface, and the queue interface requires you to have NQ and DQ, so we do provide overriding operations for NQ and DQ in our protected queue. Okay? Don't fuss about the overlaps between generic and abstract here. Okay. Where does the queue interface come from? The queue interface is defined in the qpack abstract. If you go back to the definition here, then you see the type queue interface is a synchronized interface. Okay. Goodie. So play with this a little bit. I know this is fairly demanding. Now, the implementation is we have been using the same implementation as before. There is no change there. But here comes the way how to actually make use of that. This is a concrete program. So this is the end of package definitions here. This is our main. Our main program here has to now instantiate all of these packages. And it has to do this in the right sequence. And the correct sequence here is the following. We have our QPack abstract, and we generate an actual existing one, QPack abstract with a character, by instantiating QPack abstract with the parameter character as the type for element. Okay. Then we have our queue size, there's nothing there. And here comes the slightly interesting part. When I now create this new QPack character, I can instantiate this one as a new QPack concrete with the already instantiated package and the queue size. Okay. So, and now to make it really interesting. So that I go through that faster than most students would be able to follow on time. So this is a little bit on purpose because this is rather advanced. Not all of you have to actually go through that. This is now a type definition which is defined as access all to queue interface class. That means I have now defined a type which I can use to refer to all instantiations, to all declarations of this queue. If I have many queues in my system, this queue class can now refer to all of them. Okay. Okay. This is a very long question. Abby, can you actually take care of that for a moment? Okay. Thanks. So, I define two tasks. These tasks are actually not types. They're actually defining two tasks directly. And the implementation of these two tasks now make use of what we have been doing so far. Both of these tasks, this is the implementation for the queue holder, this is the implementation for the queue user, two separate tasks. They can actually run on different machines, if you like, to make it more interesting. It doesn't have to be on your one laptop, can actually run on the other side of the world, if you like. Both of them are declaring a local queue, which is a new protected queue, as we have defined before. Nothing spectacular. Both of them have now a local queue available. Sounds pretty boring. So what can we do with that? I'm using an interface which I have not seen before, a message passing interface, which allows me to send the information about this queue, to send the reference to this queue to the other tasks. So this task is sending this queue to the queue user who is accepting this queue as a remote queue. Or he calls this thing as in his parameter here as a remote queue. And now comes the part which is a little mind-bending. I now call NQ on both of these queues. I call NQ on the remote queue and I call NQ on the local queue. And syntactically, this looks completely identical. I have a queue, dot all, don't worry about this one, is a dereferencing thing because it's a reference and I have to actually say that I want to not have the reference but the actual object. Don't worry about the syntax. It's the same syntax. And I call NQ on both of these queues. But this queue here is in a completely different task. In fact, it could be on a different computer, on a different partition. And so what the programming language, your compiler, has to do here is radically different from what it has to do here. This is a local queue, uses your protected object, quite simply. This is a remote queue, which means that you have to take care, where is this task running? Is this task running on my same machine? Do I have to now make an interface into another task here? It could be a remote procedure call, which means it's on another computer, which means I need to encode the parameter into something that can be sent over the internet, which can be decoded on the internet, which on the other side, when received from the internet, it can be potentially being executed on a machine which has another byte order on its memory. So it could be completely different, and the implementation behind that is orders of magnitudes more complicated than this implementation. Nevertheless, it looks the same. So that's one of the extreme powers of dynamic dispatching, making something that looks quite harmless in a concurrent distributed environment can turn into extensive pieces of code. Okay. So, tunneling through network using remote data structures. And if I read out then the result, if I say DQ on this one, I will actually read out the character which has been put here in a completely different task, and it pops up inside this task because this task used the internal queue of that task. Okay, take a deep breath. What was the meaning of access on the previous slide? Good question. Access simply means this is a reference to something. This is the ADA definition of saying I want to have a pointer to something rather than the thing itself. I want to have a reference to something. Access all means I have a reference which I can use for reading and writing. If I only say access, I will have a read-only reference. We will need this later in concurrent programming so that you can hand over references to something without the danger of messing things up. So you have only a read reference instead of a read-write reference. This is too advanced to go into further details at this point. Okay. Why does the above read R, not L? Because we put R in here. This task received the queue from the queue holder above and stuffed this R character into this queue, remote queue, NQ, and boop, it turns up into this queue. Okay? Okay. Yep. Excellent. So that's ease, take a deep breath. This was the steepest part of the lecture. This was quite advanced. Go through this step by step, and if you like to, and ask me tons of questions on the forums to clarify further if you feel like it. If you don't feel like it, focus on the rest of the lecture. This is more important at this time to understand the foundations here. So this is the end of the ADA language introduction. I don't want to go any further in this one. Is ADA the most dominant programming language on the planet? Obviously not, and very far from it. Is ADA alive and kicking? Certainly it is, and you will find it in a lot of high-integrity systems worldwide, high-speed train systems. Ironically, pretty much every subway system, every metro system on this planet is actually programmed in ADA. These guys are really paranoid about safety and security and timing, and they use usually very strong languages to do that. And obviously for aviation and space operations, that also goes quite easily. Okay. Don't have to go. Essentially because message parsing is synchronized. Yes, this specific form of message parsing which we have been using here is synchronized, but we will talk about asynchronous message parsing later on. Okay. So these tasks execute concurrently? Yes, of course, these two tasks which you have seen on the previous slide execute, of course, concurrently. Yeah. And possibly on different computers. That concurrently, even concurrently and distributed, if you like to. Okay. So, ba-ba, new programming language. Why do we need a new programming language? Well, Ada has one thing missing, namely a decent approach to data parallelism. If you want to program this, Ada and pretty much any other programming language is pretty clunky. So use a clunky programming language with a lot of extra libraries to make it go, or use a programming language which has been designed from the ground up into parallel operations, and Cray, as an old traditional company which have been growing up with supercomputers, is in the pole position to do that. This was actually coming out of a competition for many different programming languages. Other companies put in, other consortium also put in attempts to that one. Chapel is the only language which actually survived from that and has been somewhat accepted by the community and is actually used in supercomputer centers to a degree. This community is quite slow in adapting new methods because there is a tremendous amount of essential code written there, and you will be surprised how many supercomputers are actually operated in, hold on to something, Fortran. Because parallel Fortran, highly concurrent Fortran, has been growing into that as well. Of course, from a computer scientist point of view, you will make a face now. So that, well, haven't made any progress in the last 50 years. Yes, we did. One of these is called Chapel. So, what do we have in Chapel? What's the difference between parallel and concurrent? Great, thanks for this question. concurrent means that things are running somewhat side by side, but you don't care how it actually runs. So if it's running concurrently, that means that it can run like that, can run like that. So one is actually already completed before the other one starts, can run just at the same time, can overlap a little bit, and you don't care. It's concurrent. You don't know in which order these two tasks will actually run. Parallel execution is different. Parallel execution means that you actually run code in codes parallel to each other in lockstep. So they're actually running exactly side by side. This is parallel execution. Okay. Data parallelism is, again, fuzzifying that term a little bit because the concept is it runs side by side, but on the physical level, this could look a little different again. So those are conceptual definitions which I gave you. How this looks on the actual CPUs is often a little hard to tell. And we will talk about this a little later in the lecture, actually. Okay, so we do use Chapel mostly for its concurrent data operations. It also has task-level parallelism and synchronization mechanisms. They are, honestly, compared to Ada, very basic. I would not recommend knocking yourself out on those operations, but these operations are extremely powerful. Let's have a look how this looks in concrete code. One of the beauties, and which actually made me also select Chapel for this course, by the way, is that it's an extremely compact programming language, which where you can make the lights dim in your suburb with a few lines of code, because it produces such extremely parallel code without all the clutter and overhead of other programming languages to first to define tasks, to go into all definition details what you want to have concurrent. You just say, I want to assign this to something else, and Chapel notices, ooey, this can be done. Data parallel, let's fire up 5,000 CPUs. Woo! Okay, let's see how that goes. The first one is just a very nifty thing, which once you have seen that, you wonder why not every programming language has that. Namely, you have a definition which is called config constants, which means later on when you start your program from command line, you can actually override these constants by operations like this. I can now start this program, which let's say the program is called stencil, and then I have dash dash n is 500, so I can just override this constant as a configuration constant while I start the program. Beautiful, easy. Okay. Oh, somebody likes to have the feature of dim the lights in your suburb. Yeah, okay. You will see how to do that in a moment. That is assuming you have your supercomputer already online in your cellar, of course. So, high-performance supercomputer languages are going very differently about the concept of arrays and matrices like other programming languages. In your off-the-mill programming language, you have your arrays, which are usually starting at zero and going someplace. Now in Ada, it's a little bit more comfortable. You can have them starting anywhere you want. Supercomputer languages go a lot further than that. This goes for any dimensional structure. You can have them going from anywhere you want, which means that matrix with borders, for example, is a three-dimensional structure which has three dimensions, each going from 0 to n plus 1. This is matrix with borders. You will see in a second why we need that. Now we cut a slice out of this. Those are just domain definitions. They are not defining an array here or a matrix. These domain definitions can then be further refined by saying I have my actual matrix, which is a matrix with borders, but I'm only taking the interior of it. So I'm only taking the array slice, so to speak, the matrix slice from 1 to n, which is the inside of this three-dimensional structure. I ignore the complete outside ring, the outside border of it, and cut the inside of it. Something that you need all the time in supercomputing, that you can dice and slice your data along any axis and in any geometrical form you see fit. Hence, it has complex operations to slice further operations out of that one. For example, slicing a single border out of it, which means I'm taking the matrix exterior by deteriorating two dimensions and using only one element of the higher dimension, which means this is a two-dimensional array. Take my word for it that this actually is that. So then I can actually define something. I define field, that's the name, which is a matrix with borders of type real, which is just a three-dimensional array, three-dimensional matrix, which goes from 0 to n plus 1. The next field is a slightly smaller version of that. This only goes over the domain matrix, which is a three-dimensional matrix which goes from 1 to n. Okay, this is just data declarations here so that we can define matrices which we can then work with. Cool. Exactly. NumPy actually has quite similar ideas around those definitions. So then I produce a single function. Okay, all functions are called procedures in Chapel. Live with it. It's a function. So this function takes a reference to our matrix. It takes an index. This index is three-dimensional, has a type. It's the type index of my matrix type. And it returns a real value. Now what it does is classical supercomputing stuff. It is a heating distribution function, very simplistic. It takes the six surrounding cells in a specific spot of my matrix and calculates the average. Oh, excuse me, by just adding them up, dividing them by six. This is just the arithmetic average of the six surrounding cells in a specific spot of my matrix. Don't fuss about this. This is not important. This is just an operation which I can apply to a specific cell in my matrix. Okay. If I do just matrix is from 1 to n, from 1 to n, then it's not no longer compatible with the other one. So you derive these domains so that they stay compatible with each other. Okay. So now let's write a program. Let's start dimming the lights. So what you do here is you first initialize your variable fields on a single border to the initial border. Initial border is scalar. Why on earth I'm not getting a syntax error right now? Initial border is a scalar, say 5. And I say my field at the domain single border, which is a two-dimensional array slice, is 5. Huh? A two-dimensional arrow is assigned to 5. Now, this is what is called promotion of operators. That means it assumes that you don't mean to assign 5 to a two-dimensional array. You obviously mean to assign 5 to every element of a two-dimensional array, right? This is what it does. And it does that, if you're lucky, highly concurrent already. So at this point, you have a 10,000 by 10,000 by 10,000 matrix, and you assign 5 to 10,000 by 10,000 elements as fast as this machine possibly can. This is just a for loop. This is the most unspectacular part of this whole thing, which I break out of at some point. And this is an interesting operation. This looks like a for loop, but it says for all. And for all is a beautiful idea. For all matrix indices in matrix, we will do the following. The next field at this matrix index is defined as applying the function stencil to this field at this matrix index. So I have now, think GPU, highly concurrent image processing, you want to process, you want to smooth, anti-alias, oversample, sharpen, whatever you want to apply to your picture, but you want to apply this to all pixels in your picture or all elements in your high-dimensional matrix in a more scientific environment. And you just say, I have my little stencil function, this function which has to be applied to everybody, and I say, for all elements in my matrix, just apply the stencil function at all of these indices. And our programming languages, which we're used to, what they of course do is, they go now sequentially through 10,000 by 10,000 by 10,000 elements. What Chappell does here is, it checks out what kind of hardware am I connected to here. Now, with your 8-core laptop or your 4-core or your 16-core, whatever you have, laptop, this is probably not quite dimming the lights in your suburb yet, but if you have a large array of machines hooked up in your basement and Chappell has been told about those, it will actually use those and produce with just those two lines a tremendously parallel operation. This tremendously parallel operation is here needed to be done in two lines for an unfortunate constraint, namely, I have to actually first define my matrix indice before I can go into this operation. And later on, we'll see we can actually do this in one line easy, but not when we actually need an index. Okay. As parallel as it gets, yes. And you don't need to worry about that. This is now you hand it over to your compiler. Your compiler knows what hardware it is compiling for, so just leave it to your compiler to make it as data parallel and as concurrent as possible on your hardware, and you don't have to worry about that. For high-performance computing, this is bliss. This is perfect. Okay. So, now this is interesting. Now we have a really complex operation, which says I want to have the difference between the previous field and the current field in every single entry. So this minus has to be applied to all your 10,000 by 10,000 by 10,000 elements. Will Chapel make use of concurrency here? Step one. Then you take the absolute value of that. Again, can be highly data parallel. And then I reduce that. No, sorry, I reduce that with the absolute value. So I use absolute value for all of that. And I reduce, sorry, talking rubbish. I reduce that with a maximum value. So I want to find in all of my abstract of differences, absolute value of differences. Let me get this right. Absolute values of differences. I want to find the maximum value in my matrix. And both of these operations can be highly data parallel. Finding the maximum value in a high dimensional array. Say you want to find the maximum value of 16 elements in a one dimensional array. How many comparisons, how many steps do you need in time to calculate the maximum value out of 16 existing values? 15, that's the sequential answer. That is wrong. In a data parallel world, you don't need 15 comparisons. 4, better. Exactly. Because what you do is, if I have 16 values in my linear array, then I can, in parallel, always take pairs of that. I take 16 values and always compare two neighbors of that and take the maximum of that. So in one step, I reduce my 16-element array to an 8-element array. Next step, I reduce the 8-element array to a 4-element array. 2, 1, done. Like a binary tree reduction, as opposed to you have to do that sequentially. Does Chapel know that trick? Yes, of course. So Chapel does that for you completely automatically. It creates a binary tree to reduce these operations highly data parallel for you without you having to write a single line of code. Just hang on for a second. Imagine in your mental eye at the moment, how much code do you have to write in your favorite programming language to make that go? Now think about binary trees, designing the tree, getting the data structure right, getting the reduction operation right, traversing the tree, distributing the tree operations over many tasks, finding out how many tasks you have, creating these tasks. I stop here. How many pages of code have been produced already? Probably 3, 4 while I was just talking. And this is just one line in a data parallel language. This is why we introduce Chapel, because you don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time. You can just use these structures to have highly powerful data parallel operations without any further fuss. Then we assign the next field to the previous field, and this is also data parallel. It's just 3D array to a 3D array slice. The next field is a little smaller than the original one, so we assign now the inner area of the field of the actual field which we are holding in one assignment. So array slicing along many dimensions in just one single assignment. No, I don't know any other programming language besides supercomputer programming languages and specified libraries which can do things like that. Okay. It's a concurrent fault, like you have seen in Ada. Yes, so for those who have been used to functional programming, here is the syntax which you would see in functional programming. This is exactly the same logical operation. You fold a list by the value max, initialized by min bound. In Haskell, you actually have to provide that. And you apply that to zip, which means you apply a minus operator to two lists and zipping them together into one list, and then you fold this list into a single value with max. That was the explainer for functional programmers. Everybody else is now utterly confused, so ignore that. This was only if you're actually familiar with functional programming. Otherwise, this line really doesn't make any sense to imperative programmers at the moment. Super. That was that. That is the introduction to give you a feel for what we will do around about the middle of the course when we go to data parallel operations. And you will be using this on your machine as well. I also already prepared the sandboxed compiler for our submission app to know Chapel as well, so they can do Chapel submissions later on and see what's going on during your submission as well.
Are you skipping my question deliberately, or did you just not see it?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay.
So, does Chapel do all of this in lockstep?
We're like doing this multi-stage concurrent thing on something that's larger than our available hardware, while it's doing the first step of whatever's left, does it then go on to the second step for the other parts?
Yes.
It
doesn't work for it. That's a very good question, which speaks to can only come from somebody who actually knows the danger of if that doesn't happen right. So if you, for example, take the reduction of a binary tree, so you have your 16 values there, and you say you want to reduce in the first step, the first level of your tree from 16 entries to 8 entries, and then you want to go further. Now, obviously, you can only go further once you have the result of the previous stage. So there need to be some waiting, some synchronization, so that you are sure that the previous steps are completed and done. This does not need to be in lockstep, but it has to be synchronized. So depending on the underlying hardware, this can be in lockstep, leave that to Chapel, or it can be just plain synchronized. In either case, it's safe. So Chapel will never fuss about this and let it just run, hoping that the values will be there by the time you need it. It will make sure that the values will be there by the time you need it, either by providing lockstep operations or by providing synchronization operations. On your laptop, it will provide synchronization operations.
Cool, thanks. That's really nice.
Cool. Any other questions for that so far? This is what you have seen, a little bit of language discussion here. Don't think there was... can you please explain the meaning of reduce again? Okay. Reduce means I want to reduce a higher dimensional structure, say a list or an array, to a single scalar value. So you want to boil an array down to a single value. And there are a number of different ways how this is useful. For example, you want to know what is the minimum value in my array. So you're boiling this whole array down into the minimum value. And for that, you have to, in Haskell or other languages, you have to go through the whole array one by one, and you find out which is the minimum value, and then you return the minimum value as a single scalar. So reducing means you are taking a higher dimensional structure, boiling it down to a single scalar. What operation are used for the boiling down? Can be a lot of different things, can be absolute value, minimum, maximum, etc. As long as you have two inputs and a single output, you can reduce any higher dimensional structure to a single scalar. Does that make some sense? Super. Okay. Would max not return a single value? Yes, of course, max would return a single value. And it is applied many, many times over, always to two neighboring elements in my highly dimensional structure until there's only one left. And this applying it many times over until there's only one left, this is done automatically by Chapel for you. Why would reduce be necessary then? Well, it depends what you think is necessary. If you don't want to know what the maximum value in your matrix is, it's not necessary. But if you want to calculate the maximum value by other means, it will probably be a lot slower because then you have to go sequentially through your matrix and ask, is this the maximum value? No, is this the maximum value? No, it's not bigger than what I had seen before. Is this the maximum value? So you do this sequentially, which is obviously a lot slower.
I think that question was more if the maximum operation is getting converted anyway, then why do we also have this reduced option?
No, the maximum operation is not promoted in the same way. So it's a good question, but I would like to defer that because that's a little bit too complicated to differentiate between the operator promotion features and the reduce function here. Short answer would be if you need something like a binary tree structure to find the final value, it is called a reduce, and you will need to use a reduce operation. Okay. Okay. Do you understand what reduce is doing in the context of getting the maximum value? Okay, let me get back to that for a moment. Okay. We're talking about this line here, right? So everything right of that one, absolute of blah, 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 is not reducing the size of our data structure. So everything right of here is still producing a high-dimensional matrix. This high-dimensional matrix has scalar numbers in it. And I want to have all of these hundreds of thousands of scalar numbers reduced to a single scalar by saying I'm only interested in the maximum value of that. And in order to do this efficiently, I'm using a reduce operation so that I can do this in a divide-and-conquer fashion. In a binary tree fashion, that I can always use two side by side, reduce them to a smaller structure, and iteratively reduce the size of my data structure always by a factor two in every step I take. Does that make some more sense? So reduce specifies how we want to perform the maximum operation. Yes. I could also say I just want to go iteratively through this whole thing, but that would need to be done in an actual for loop, okay? Which would already express how slow that will be. I mean, how slow that would be. Talking down a little bit how slow that would be, until 10 minutes ago, we all have been still doing that exactly with all of our programming languages without further hesitation or asking. Now you're assuming that this can be done like that in a concurrent world, and of course you're switching over to this mindset instantly and will never go back to why would I ever do these kind of operations in a sequential way. Cool. that was the language refresher. And I would like to move on from language definitions. You should have enough basic programming ideas to get enough starting points for next week's lab. We also have a question that can we publish the lab material a priori. Of course, I will post the lab material for next week today. All right. So I think the questions are beginning to settle. Abby, correct me. Are we somewhat in the clear at the moment?
Yeah, I think so.
It shouldn't be fine. Excellent.